And I am having a fun day here at the CBA banquet. I am back with another episode of the CBA's ABCs of Bow Hunting. Sitting across from me is, in my eyes, a little bit of a legend, but I don't want to blow your head up too much. Mr. Paul Navarre, how are you, sir?
I'm excellent. Thank you very much.
Saw you across the room, and I just sprung it on you. I said, hey, can we sit down and record for a minute? And I appreciate your willingness to join me here today. How you been? How's your last year been? How's everything?
Well, the last year's been great. I've been mentally and physically strong and still moving forward, as I always say. Just keep putting one foot in front of the others, and just have a positive attitude about life. And, you know, as we were just talking about, I just turned 82 March 7th.
Man, incredible.
I've been blessed with the ability to keep strong, but I work at it. Yeah. I've been going to the same gym in Fort Collins, Colorado for 21 years. I work out most every other day in the winter, and then I ride my mountain bike on the rural roads of Colorado, and then I do some hiking with a backpack and my black lab prior to elk season, trying to knock off 5 pounds, but just get strong so I can go backpacking up in the mountains. And I do a lot of solo hunting, so I rely on my own wood skills and my own safety and my own reliance on my skills to hunt elk or deer or turkeys or whatever is in season. And how did last year go? Well, pretty exceptional year. I filled every tag that I had gotten. Oh. It started out in Arizona in January, and this will be my ninth trip to Arizona to hunt cows, deer.
Yeah.
And I hunt them on public land, and I've killed the sixth one a year ago.
Really?
Yes.
Man, I hear they are very difficult, and I think it's a combination of the landscape, the heat, and then just they're a spooky animal.
They are.
Sort of, have you found in six times of having success that there's something you're doing consistently?
Yes. I'm treating them like Midwestern whitetails and hunting them just like that. Not out in the open prairie like you see some TV shows where rifle hunters are shooting them at 500 yards. Because they can't get any closer, or maybe bow hunters. And I really give a lot of credit to any bow hunter that can, in open country, in rocky country, can get within bow range of a cow's deer. And that's a lot of skill.
Yeah.
But I have elected, since I have to drive 1,200 miles to get down there, and I can spend the whole season if I need to. But I found out they're just whitetails, and they're not around egg country.
Uh-huh.
So once you find where they want to live and find water, escape routes, places they can live properly, food, of course, breeding areas. And I found that in the mountain areas. So I'm hunting at 6,000 feet.
Interesting.
Yes. And it's very thick. And I read a long time ago, if bow hunters hunt where it's thicker, the gun hunters can't shoot them at long ranges. Okay. And so there's more apt to be more deer around after gun seasons, because I'm hunting in January. It's archery only for deer in Arizona in January. So I go down then. And the rut for cows deer is about the middle of January.
Is it?
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
So I know cows is a separate species of deer.
It is.
Did it subspecies. Okay.
So it is a white-tailed deer.
It is a white-tailed
deer. Yes. It's just like the same whitetail that's up in northern Saskatchewan, but they have to weigh 250, 300 pounds to survive that cold weather.
Yeah.
And you have the Keys deer down in Florida that were very small, but they don't have to get to be 200 pounds because of the weather down there. And the same way with the cows deer in southern Arizona and in Mexico and in southwestern New Mexico. That's where they are. That's where they occupy.
And they're a smaller body species.
They're just, a large male. First of all, they stand about 32 to 34 inches at the shoulders.
Really?
Yes. So waist high at the most. And I think the state record as far as antler growth was about 130. So you take a 130-point rack, Pope and Young, and stick it on a 110-pound deer, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So Pope and Young measurements for them is 70 inches.
Really?
And the one I have displayed out here at the banquet is 72 3/8.
We got to take a picture of that.
And it's a really nice little 4x4 with some decent brow tines. And I shot him at 9 yards. I was on the ground and watching a little water hole that was coming off of a little creek.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
And solo hunting.
So I treat them just like whitetails. I've hunted them out of tree stands and killed them that way. I use ground blinds. And I've only killed one spot and stalking. I saw him following a doe through the woods, and I got out in front of him and ambushed him and shot him at 20 yards. But the one last year, I was actually helping a young man pack his deer out because I was riding out of camp on my bike, and he was coming down the road, and I had met him the day before. And I said, "Jimmy, how you doing?" He said, "Oh, I just shot my first buck." And I went, "Do you need some help getting him out?" He says, "Well, yeah." I says, "Well, follow me down to my camp. I'll get my backpack, and we'll take your truck and go up there." And I was kind of interested where he got it anyway. He says, "Yeah, because I got to leave tonight and go see my wife." I said, "I'll help you." So we park in an area that I had never seen before, just a couple miles from my camp. And we go down this trail, and this country is beautiful. And it's rolly, it's mountainous. Way up above us is a real big cliff with a waterfall coming down. And so there's certain country that the deer can be in and won't be in. But this looked like perfect country. As we're going in along this trail, the trail parallels a little creek. But 2 years ago, there was a big drought in Arizona, and there was no water coming down the creek except right where we crossed the trail. There was a little seep coming out under the trail and putting two little ponds in the dry creek bottom.
Wow.
And I looked at that. And when you go hunting and you walk into an area and go, "Wow, this is deery. This looks elky. Mm-hmm. This looks whatever animal you're after." If I was one of them, I would want to be here because it has everything I need. I can see food. I can see shelter. I can see water. Wow. And so the next day, that evening, I came down there and looked around to say, okay, where can I set up? Well, the deer could come from anywhere, but I knew that I had the cold currents coming down the creek. So I got next to some two great big ponderosa pine trees and just knelt down in the pine needles and sat there looking around. And right before last shooting, like maybe 20 minutes, I see a doe out in the flat. And then 10 minutes later, here comes a buck right along the edge of the creek, the old creek bed, about 30 yards away. And he just turns. He comes down the creek bottom. He comes around the tree at 9 yards. I'm at full draw with my compound, and I shot him at 9 yards. Yeah.
And that's exciting.
Yeah, it was very exciting. Yeah.
You mentioned a bike. Are you using an e-bike?
No. I just have a mountain bike.
With a trailer on it?
Nope. This is just to ride around on the gravel roads.
Gotcha.
And I only used it over there just to get some exercise.
Yeah.
Or use it a little bit. But I don't have an e-bike now.
I got an e-bike a year and a half ago, and I love it. However, my buddy put something in my head. He says, "Man, if I had an e-bike, I'd only go where you're allowed to use an e-bike."
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the biggest deer I killed over there was about 150 miles farther east. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry, farther west. And I was in a ground blind that I just took some camo netting and put on some old golf shafts and stuck it in the ground and taped the blind on it, and so I could make a little surround blind.
Yeah.
And had a little seat. And I knew that there was a funnel area in front of me where the coos or cows were coming off the real dry desert, rocky sticker brush cactus stuff.
Yeah.
And then coming down into this creek bottom and drinking water behind me. And I'd seen some young deer coming in front of my blind throughout the morning, mostly does and fawns. But about 10 o'clock, I see this doe coming down the hill, and right behind her is the biggest buck I'd ever seen as far as coos. And he ended up scoring in the 90s.
Wow.
Yes. And so as he came towards me, the doe came by me at about 25 yards and went past the trail. He stopped for some reason and was looking around. I had my grunt call in my pocket, and I just blew into my pocket shirt and made a little grunt sound. He came forward. He followed the doe and stopped. I was on my knees. Now, remember I said they're no taller than 3 feet off the ground?
Yeah.
And when I'm kneeling and have my bow up in my hand, I'm higher than that.
Yeah.
And because of their small size, they look farther away, so I aimed higher. And guess what? Shot right over his back at 25 yards.
Man.
And I didn't say, "Oh, man, I almost..." And off he went.
And do you generally not need to use a rangefinder, or 25 yards, you know what 25 yards
is? I didn't have time.
Gotcha.
Didn't have time.
Yeah.
And so off he went following the doe. Well, then about 20 minutes later, I see him heading back up that way with the doe, chasing her back up into the flats away from me. So there were two cows, deer, does ahead of me. They'd been there all along. And they moved away slightly, but then one wasn't spooked, both of them. One went and bedded down about 60 yards away because it was now around 11 o'clock. And the other one was feeding about 60 yards away. So I decided to leave my backpack and, unfortunately, my water bottle, and I'd crawl up behind some plants.
Yeah.
And get behind a little tree and wait there to see what would happen. Sure enough, at noon, this is why I wrote the story, High Noon Buck. This buck comes back down in there. He goes over to the bed of doe and tries to get her up. She jumps up and doesn't want to mess with him. He then goes over to the buck that is standing 22 yards from me, looking at me now because I've been moving around. He comes up and touches her butt. She spins around and leaves him broadside. I'm at full draw, and I shoot him with an arrow. Off he goes and disappears. I go over there, and I can't find my arrow. I can't find any blood. And I wait for a while, you know, you're 20, 30 minutes. And I go up, and now I'm in this rocky flat area. And I do a grid search. And luckily, an hour later, maybe 150 yards farther, I find him there dead.
Wow.
Nice buck. The arrow had hit him not too far back, but it had angled a little high. And he bled eternally. Okay, that's what happened. So there wasn't any, But I found him, and he was a great buck. And I actually have his shoulder mounted home. He's a beautiful find, just a beautiful buck. Their features are so pretty.
Could you walk me through what your hunting year looks like? I think it's awesome that you find ways to hunt nearly year round.
Yes.
So if you're going to hunt turkey in a couple of weeks, and you say you start your year in Arizona in January.
Sure.
What is January to December? What's that generally look like?
Well, I tell people I can hunt almost 9 months of the year, and then the other 3 months or 2.5 months I go fishing. So went January. Okay. And then let's see, there was February, March. So at the end of March, I'm heading to Nebraska to do their archery only season, which is the last week in March and the first couple of weeks in April before the gun season starts.
For turkeys.
So I go over there, and I'd been hunting this one state wildlife area for many years. I've probably killed 50, 60 birds there. And I use a blind, and I use a decoys, a subordinate Jake over a hen with a couple trailing off to the right or left, a couple of two hens just to make it more real. Sure. I'll even put a string around the Jake's neck because he's on a stake and I can bob him and turn him. Yes. And run that stick under a little log in front of the decoys and then back to the blind, and I can make him movement. So I can use my box call, my diaphragm, and to see if there's any birds in the area. And even after I've roosted them, sometimes they'll go the other way and go up into the hills and do their messing around up there. And then sometimes around 9 or 10 o'clock, maybe a tom will come back to check that area again. And so you get them early in the morning. Sometimes you get them at 9 or 10 o'clock and maybe at 3 in the afternoon. So you hunt them all day. So I went over there and I did that. I killed two and went over there and killed one. And then I came back 10 days later and killed another one. The first one was shot at 15 yards, and the next one, the turkey came behind me and was walking right out in front of my blind to the decoys 15 yards away, and I did one of those Texas heart shots on him and shot him at 10 yards from the blind.
Wow.
So then I took one of Danny Ferris's Ultimate Predator turkey decoys, turkey decoys, and went up the Scott's Bluff. And that's where I went on the mountain bike, got over there. That turkey came from 150 yards away, and he had hens, and that's a big key there. If you can get a tom with hens, he's more apt to come because he wants to defend his little harem. Well, this turkey came all the way up within 5 yards, and I shot him. So
decoy mounted to your bow.
That's right. Yeah. And that when he develops, has a shoot-through window, and it only weighs 11 ounces.
Yeah.
So there's hardly any.
As long as there's not wind.
That's right. So coos deer, three turkeys. So then I draw a pronghorn tag for Craig. Area 3301. Takes about 4 preference points to draw that area, and I've hunted it twice over the years, but this go around it took 5. So I went over to this private property where I've hunted over the years. Lack of water, but luckily a big rainstorm came through about a month before the season started and filled up this one tank that I'd never been hunting before. So I go there, and a lot of does and fawns all throughout the day, but then at 4 o'clock, way up on the hill, now it's 100 degrees inside my blind, so I'm stripped down to, you know, man.
Yeah, it's hot.
Yeah, it's warm. So I'm down to my shorts. It's warming out. And I'm always thinking, I'll go back to camp and come back at 4 o'clock when it's cooled down. I said, no, stick it out. If I'm hot, these pronghorn are getting hot, they might come in the water. So around 2:30, I look way up on the hill and I see a couple does up there, and like 400 yards away, and I went, oh, and then all of a sudden a buck pops up. And they came down to drink. He stood up there until they were finished drinking. And then they left, and he came down, and he walks right up to the water's edge, and he's facing me. And I've got my compound bow. It's exactly 32 yards across the water.
Wow.
and he turned slightly farther than quartering away to me. And I shot with a mechanical broadhead. I just thought I'd try him out. I had a Rage.
Yeah.
And it struck him a little high on his shoulder, but went up and severed his spine. 1 second he was alive, and the next, before he hit the ground, he was dead.
Yeah.
It just went instant Drunk. Death, just boom, yeah. right at the water's edge. And that European mount that I made is out there on the wall out here. And awesome. Really scored 62, but he's just a nice little representative of a nice pronghorn. So I got that great meat to eat. So then I hunt elk up in the Flat Top Wilderness area. And my bucket list goal this year or last year was to kill a bull elk with my recurve bow.
Yeah. How'd it go?
It went very well.
Oh, man.
So the year before, out of a tree stand, right near my camp up there, because I stay there for a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. water out of the creek, freeze-dried food, shoot a grouse, get some currant berries off the bushes, you know, just kind of caveman type. And just enjoy it. I take a diary. I took a book to read. I got my camera to take pictures. Noon naps are wonderful up in the timber. And so the year before I was in a tree stand and I had a bull come in the third evening and I had a lighted knock malfunction. I didn't know the lighted knock was fitting too tight to my service string because it was the same lighted knock that I was using on my compound bow.
Yeah.
And of course the compound bow shooting 260 feet per second, so there was no issue there.
Yeah.
But the recurve bow I'm using is only shooting 170 feet per second.
Yeah.
So what happened, I drew back on this bull standing broadsided at 18 yards. I'm only 8 feet off the ground on the tree stand, so it's almost level. I'm pretty sure I was going to kill him. And when I released, I saw the arrow kick off to the right about 30 degrees and then just dive right at the feet of the elk.
It separated from the knock.
What happened, the nut stuck too tight to the string, and in just that mini second, it hung on too much. It was enough to kick it off.
Damn.
And that's what I said, damn. So off he went. And so I think I went home for a couple of days, and I came back with my compound bow, and I went to a different wallow a half a mile away, and I killed a bull in the wallow on the 17th of September 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So last year, I said, okay, Paul, you're not getting any younger. All right. And before your shoulder or your muscles can't pull back your 55-pound recurve anymore, you need to check this off your bucket list. So I practiced out to 20 yards. I was shooting really good. And I put a one sight pin on my recurve bow.
Yeah.
Okay. And it has improved my accuracy 200% and my reliability of shooting at 20 yards.
Just having a point of reference.
Just have a point of reference, yeah.
Gotcha.
I know some guys like Tom Clum and a few others can shoot their recurves. They've got skills. They got natural skills, but they've got built-in memory skills that they've done over the years. And I have some skills, but I'd rather rely on a little aid. Like
confidence is everything out there.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
And so I went back to the same. So I was up there for 9 days and saw very little action. But last year it was very warm. It was up to 80 degrees during the day at 10,200 feet. So about 9 days after I hunted up there and not seeing much action, and not even over the water hole where I eventually killed this elk, I could only hunt there in the evening, mm-hmm. about an hour and a half, because I didn't want to be there during the day when the thermals were going up the hill through their bedding area. And I didn't want to hike across this big meadow in the morning in the dark to spook elk off of there. So that was one spot that I would only hunt in the evening. So I got there about 6:30 when the wind started coming in my favor, and I sat down behind the same big ponderosa tree. And this is a wilderness area, so this whole area is maybe, half acre.
Yeah.
And that's all you can see. And the wallow is 20 yards away. Well, this bull came from my right. He disappeared for a while, and then he showed up right out in front of me. And he bugled right at first bugle I'd heard all season, the 15th of September. And then he put his head down to drink. And as he was turning away, I moved over slightly, came to full draw, launched a 600 grain arrow at him with a 175 grain VAP broadhead. I thought it hit him back, but actually it hit him back, but it angled towards his front shoulder. And it took out a liver and a lung. He raced past me into the timber. And 20 minutes later, it's going to be dark.
Yeah.
So I went over there and found some blood, but not spraying blood.
Yeah.
I didn't find blood with lung blood in it or bubbles.
Right.
I'm standing there, and I hear this moaning. back in the timber, and it sounded just like a moo cow.
Yeah.
And I know there had been some cattle in the area previously, but last year there weren't any cattle up there. Uh-huh. And I went, ooh, I wonder if that's that elk's death moans. And sure enough, I traced, went right over there towards it, and there I found him dead. Wow. So when he hit the ground, all that oxygen that was in his lungs was dissipating through his mouth and nose, and he was moaning, and that's where I found him, and there he was, a nice 5x5 bull. And so I had, now I can check that off my bucket list. Yeah, I was thrilled. And I'll, and even though he was my, I've killed a couple cows and a couple spikes, but the rest have been branch antler bulls. No big 6x6s. They've been 4x4s, 4x5s, and 5x5s. Yeah, I've never killed a 6-point yet, but being an archer, I still got time to do it. Would I love to kill a 6x6? Sure, but I tell people, like the big bull that's in there on the wall, my rack is right under it. It makes mine look like a little dwarf. I said, well, I won't kill a bull like that because first, I can't get it in my truck. Second, that rack won't even fit from my front door. And I only have 8-foot ceilings in the house. So what am I going to do with a mount like that?
Take a happy living.
Yeah, really. So then I love to go to Nebraska. And I said, you know, I've got a lot of meat. I've got still some meat from last year, elk.
Yeah.
And I turkey hunt, I goose hunt. I didn't shoot any pheasants. So I only shot a couple of ducks last year. But I'm going to go to Nebraska. I just like to hunt.
Sure.
So I go over there, and I take my recurve, and I shoot a nice, big, fat whitetail doe, my summer sausage doe. Okay. I'm going to have her all ground, except her back straps.
Yeah.
I'll have her all ground up in summer sausage, which I did. So there's another tag I filled. So coos whitetail, 3 turkey tags, a pronghorn tag, an elk tag, and a Nebraska whitetail. And then I goose hunt with my bow locally in Fort Collins.
Really?
And I land them in the ground on the decoys. Yes, it's legal. And I hunt private property. And these are yard hopper geese. And I wrote an article about that in the CBA magazine called Urban Goose Hunting.
Yeah.
And I post a lot of that on bowsight.com because guys, not only I'm not the star of it, it's my black lab, Chase the Wonder Dog, who goes and retrieves them for me if the arrow's not still in the goose. And then I do take it out and plant the goose for a blind retrieve, and then I send him at. But he's a wonderful dog, and I always show.
Are you going on for a goose? Are you going on a body shot? Are you trying to decapitate it?
No, body shot. Same thing I do on turkeys.
Yeah.
I don't do the heads things. Just like I went to the turkey seminar, and the guy was right on everything.
Yeah.
And someone asked him about using the decapitated
broadheads.
And he says, I'm a photographer, and I want to take pictures of that bird in whole. And I'm the same way. I take pictures of my birds, and then I say, I don't want to have to throw them over my shoulder and hang them by the feet and have blood on the back of my pants, or I don't want to have to tear a roll of gut tape to duct tape his head back on. So I know it's very effective, but I've been a body shot guy.
I lost a turkey last year. I put a body shot on it with a mechanical, and I never use mechanicals, and it just had enough life in it where it flew up and over a fence and onto some private, and I couldn't recover it.
Okay.
But it's got me thinking just what's the new tactic. May is coming up here, and I'm just trying to think of how should I best approach it. My thought is, let me just use the same broadhead for everything. I'm at the iron will, two blade, decently heavy arrow, but I'm curious what your thoughts on that are with using arrows on birds. Is there a method to your madness with that?
There is. So I think using, now when I shoot turkeys with my recurve, I use cut on impacts. I'll use a 3-blade or maybe even a 2-blade with bleeders. When I'm shooting with a compound, just like geese, I use mechanicals. And the mechanicals I use are the Knapp Shockwave. You can buy them for $20 for 3.
Why do you like those?
Because they're rugged and they break bones, and they have 3 blades that you can resharpen.
Oh, really?
Or replace. And they're inexpensive.
So it's like almost like a hybrid?
No, it's been around for a long time.
I mean like a mechanical component and a fixed blade component?
Oh, no, not at all. No, it's got a chisel head or a pyramid head.
Yeah.
So the first ones they came out with had a pyramid head with a neck, and then you had 3 blades that would pop out. And it had a little rubber band to hold it.
Gotcha.
There's little screws that hold those blades in. So if you need to, if one gets bent, you can replace it with others. Or all I do for turkeys and geese is I use a knife sharpener, carbide.
Yeah.
and just sharpen those blades. And then I'll take a little file and sharpen that head off and put a new rubber band on it, and they work great.
I'll have to check those out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think any decent mechanical will work. They don't destroy meat because a broad head is going to cut through the meat. It's not going to make a big hole.
Right.
Yeah. And the other thing I do with my Earls, if they're not fletched that way, which they're probably not, I take some of this Hunter Orange wrap and put it before the fletching, and you can find your Earls so easily with that Hunter Orange tape on there. And all of my arrows, for whether I shoot recurve or compound for elk or deer or anything, all my arrows have that Hunter tape on them.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I use a vein wrap as well, and it's like a neon yellow, and I find
that just helps. Yeah, yes. But even below that, so those sheets are about that long. You can buy them. I cut them in half, and I can use, you know, all I need is about, instead of buying, 8 inches long, I can use a 4-inch piece.
That's smart.
And when I was out goose hunting and there's snow on the ground, I'll miss some geese once in a while. And I had 5 arrows out there under the snow. When the snow melted, I walked its pasture and found every one of them. And I wouldn't have seen them if any go out in a bright day when that the Hunter Orange is really glowing, and I picked them up right away.
No effect on arrow flight.
No, not at all. I'm shooting turkeys at 10 and 15 yards and the geese 13 to 20 yards. Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, I filled a lot of turkey, you know, filled. So I would suggest this, even on turkeys, and I did this in a seminar.
Yeah.
I said, go on Google Earth, not Google, Google search, and find the anatomy of a turkey. And find a picture of a turkey without any feathers on it. Now, I took some pictures of some of my plucked turkeys and put them on a mat and took their pictures. So that bird that you're shooting at with no feathers on is different to the bird that is not in strut. And that bird is real different than the bird that's in full strut.
Man.
So you take a bird that has no feathers, it looks like a little dwarf.
Yeah.
Then you take that same bird and put feathers on it, now it's three times bigger.
Stronger, yeah.
Three times bigger. Now you take that same bird and put it over here in full strut, now it's 10 times bigger. And it's so difficult to figure out where you're going to shoot it.
Yeah.
But if you know the anatomy of the naked bird, and how small of an area you really have to shoot at, albeit the size of your fist.
Wow.
And what I try to do is do it broadside and aim right up their drumstick to where their drumstick enters their body, and then you get a gut shot. And that destroys a lot. Sometimes you don't even hit the breast, but you're hitting right through their guts, and you're taking out their legs, and very seldom do I have one get away. And
that's smart.
Yeah, and now...
Was that with a compound or recurve?
With a compound.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. And same thing with I think with the recurve, I hope for the best.
With the compound, sub 20 yards, do you find that you have to, like, I'm assuming your first pin is a 20-yard pin, unless you're setting it up for shorter than that. I'm asking because I shoot my living room at, like, 7 yards.
Yes.
And my 20-yard pin shoots off.
Yes.
You know, so do you, what is your methodology?
Well, I brought this up at the turkey seminar. Is that I recommend anybody, if they only have a 20-yard pin, then go to 10 yards and shoot your 20-yard pin at a target. And go back to 15 yards and go back to 20 yards and go to 20 and just see the difference.
Know what it does.
So if you can't adjust it down to 10, then make your adjustments. And it's not too much off at your 10, 15, and 20. It might only be a couple inches off, depending on the poundage of your bow.
Yeah, but a grouse or turkey, it matters.
But that can be enough. So you might have to aim a little lower, on a farther shot. But if it's at 20 or right on, then you aim a little lower for a closer shot.
Yeah.
But you got to figure that out before you go hunting. And even if you're shooting out of a blind, you should figure it out, because when you're in a blind, your depth perception is different than you're without one.
I can imagine
that. It is. It is. It seems you're looking out through a tunnel almost, looking through a blind window. And things are just, in your eye, they look differently. Whether you're shooting at a deer or shooting at a pronghorn or shooting at a turkey, it's just slightly different.
Right.
But I use a rangefinder for those things. Or even with the turkey decoys, I know exactly, like my recurve, I set them at 10 yards.
Yeah.
And that pin I have on my recurve, I can adjust it to 10 yards.
Ah.
So then I just practice at 10 yards. Yeah, and compound, then I can adjust it because I have a single pin on that one. So,
do you find jumping between the recurve and the compound, it screws your mind a little bit? Is there an adjustment period?
No, because I've learned that with the recurve bow, I shoot it vertically, just like I do my compound. I have a single pin, which I have to shoot. I can cant it maybe 2 degrees, but no more than that, because if you cant that pin switches up and over a little bit.
You're right.
So I've learned how to do that, and I anchor almost the same type. And I'm using a release on my compound and fingers on my recurve.
Right.
So I've adjusted, and I,
I bought a recurve this year just so, like, when I go out to the range and I have a girlfriend or a friend who wants to come with me, they have something to do, and it's fun for them. Shooting recurves is just a
Yeah, it fun. Is. It is.
But I recognize the vast difference between the two skill sets, you know, whether you're doing point-on shooting or instinctive or using a sight. And I recognize for me, I mean, I've only been shooting a bow for 4 or 5 years now. There's only so many things I can change in one season and be comfortable by the time the season starts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, having that confidence in your equipment, really, it's like looking in yourself in the mirror before you go out on a date and being like, oh, I look good tonight. You know, like, I feel good. I can be out there with confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to hear, and I really appreciate how much you break these things down, the anatomy of an animal, what type of arrow you're using and why, when you're using it, the type of equipment that you use, and just also providing that self-challenge of, you know what, this is the goal this year, elk with the recurve or whatever it might be. So we've talked coos deer, we've talked 3 turkeys, pronghorn, elk, whitetail, goose. Was that your full year?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate in Fort Collins, 5 minutes from my house. A friend of mine has 8 acres of property and big fields behind it and a pond. And then across this road, the state highway, is a huge lake. And these are yard hopper geese. These aren't the migratory geese that are coming down from Canada. These are the local. You go down to Walmart in town, and there's geese on the grass. You go to King Supers, or you go to the bank, there's geese walking down the street. So these geese have been born and raised and die in the area.
Yeah.
Now, they're not dumb, but they're easier to kill than migratory geese that have been shot at and also been decoyed in.
Yep.
So this year I killed 15.
Wow.
Last year I killed only 2 or 3 because it was very dry in the area and the geese weren't relating to the areas where I was hunting. Mm-hmm. And but the year before, I think I killed about 15. I got my limit one day of 5.
Wow.
But it just happened. Yeah. And so it's kind of fun. And I turn all that meat into jerky, or I have some great crock pot recipes for chunked goose breasts. Yeah. So anything that you shoot, it could be a coyote or a rattlesnake. There's got to be a recipe out there that you could actually eat that meat.
Yeah.
If you don't overcook it or something, I haven't eaten a coyote, but I've eaten rattlesnake and I've eaten woodchuck and I've tried those things.
Sure.
And the jerky, what's interesting about the jerky is that I treat it just like beef. And it's got almost the same protein content per ounce as beef does. Beef is like 25, goose is 23.
Because we're talking Canadian goose, it's like a red meat,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Very dense. And so I grind that up and I make jerky out of it. And then I take it hunting. And, you know, you can graze on jerky and some trail mix for a couple of days, drink water, and you can go on these little two-day hunts and not take a whole lot of food with you.
100%. I also have, like, a little bit of a superstition where I think it's important to eat game meat before you go hunting. Like, I think it's nice to be operating off of the thing you're trying to pursue.
Yeah, well.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Well, we eat a lot of wild game and fish and all sorts of things like that. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a couple. I want to get into some topics we talked about prior to starting, but I also just have a few general questions I like to ask people. Is there anything in your hunting history that you consider like one of your greater successes, whether it's an animal or something you've learned or an experience you had, but something that stands out in your mind as like, Paul, I'm calling this a success. I feel successful right now. It sounds like the elk with the recurve is a big one.
That was nice. And so I'm going to flashback 60 years.
Okay.
Where I killed my first deer in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan when I was in the Air Force.
Awesome.
On a sack base, off base, with a recurve bow, killed a white-tailed doe.
Wow.
So now let's fast forward to last year, where I killed my last white-tailed doe with a recurve bow, 60 years later.
Wow.
So I look at that and go, wow, where did all that time go? But in between, particularly since I moved to Colorado in 1991, Trish and I bought a tourist lodge on Lake Granby. And loving wife says, Paul, go ahead and go elk hunting during the middle of the week. I can take care of the operation. Or during season, we would close for a few days during the middle. So I'd hike back in the basins and go elk hunting. And so I never knew what the Colorado Big Eight was. Mm-hmm. I went to a banquet years ago, and some guys were gathering around talking about the Big Eight, and I thought they were talking about football. You know, the Big Eight conferences, the Big 12 conferences, right. Until I listened, and they were talking about animals, yeah. Sheeps and goats and bears and I go, wow, that's only for the experts. And so the first time I moved back here to Colorado, and I'd already killed a bull elk in the flat tops in 1989. When I lived here out of state.
It must have been a little less busy back then.
It was. There was less than 30,000 bow hunters back then.
Wow.
In 1989, yeah. And that was over-the-counter draw tags in the flat tops then. So I killed my first 4x4 bull elk. That was accomplishment. And then when I moved to Colorado, that first year I killed another bull elk over near Fraser. And then I killed a pronghorn buck a couple years later. And it made Pope and Young. I didn't know what Pope and Young was. And joined CBA back then. Mm-hmm. And then I killed probably another elk a couple years later. I killed a white-tailed deer out in Eastern Prairie. So then I had four of the species.
Yep.
And then I drew a bighorn sheep tag after 6 years and killed a nice bighorn sheep up in S32.
Oh, nice.
And then 2 years later, I killed my mountain goat.
Really?
Yes. And so all I needed then was a mountain lion and a bear.
Yeah.
And so, and being sort of a natural resource background, and I understand habitat, and I understand scouting, and I understand the lay of the lands, and then you know, there's so much information out there that you can get today versus what was available years back. I mean, I remember when there was only Field and Stream and Outdoor Magazine, and now if you're an underwater basket weaver, there's a magazine for you.
Maybe two.
Yeah, and then you got all the social media, and you got people doing scouting and selling scouting reports. So anyway, it was more difficult. But anyway, so then. After I got my bighorn sheep and I got my mountain goat, and then I had six of the species. And I'd been trying to get a bear, and Dennis Howell, who used to be the Southwest Regional Manager for CBA and a very good hunter, and he told me about a place over there that he used to spring bear hunt because you couldn't do that anymore. And I went over there and hunted bear, and it was so dry. But the last weekend, I went and I had a predator call, and I ended up calling a bear in with my predator call. Right. And it came in all bristled up looking for me as a dying fawn or wounded rabbit or something in the fence or something. And as it passed by 20 yards away, I put an arrow through both shoulders and killed that bear.
Wow.
And I went, yeah, I went, wow. Because now, so, oh, that was my eighth species.
Well, what about the lion?
Well, we sold our business in 2001. Actually, we sold it 2 months before 9/11. Not knowing that was going to happen. And when I had enough money to go lion hunting then, because I had enough money to go around the world for a week until I had to pay my bills off, but I hired Lyle Womarth, who was a guide out of Granby. And so we went mountain lion hunting in January, and I was able to, that's the only time I ever used a guide, I was able to kill a nice mountain lion.
With dogs?
With dogs, yes.
On
yeah.
Private land?
No, on public land.
I was talking to some guys, and they said, I guess now the rule is if you use a guide, it's only on private with dogs?
No. I haven't heard anything like that.
Okay.
No.
Yeah. That's fascinating to me. So if you remember, how does mountain lion taste?
Mountain lion is so lean, there's no fat.
Okay.
So you just can't throw it on the barbie and expect it to be like a prime rib piece of meat that has fat in it.
Yeah.
So you have to treat it very gently. You can wrap it in bacon. You have to cook it really slow. We made chili meat out of it. We did the backstraps and bacon, but you have to do it really carefully because even if you do it medium rare and let it rest for a while, it'll keep on cooking too much. So you got to be very careful there. Some people will say mountain lion meat's the best meat I've eaten. I would say it was about a 7.5 on a 10-point scale.
Okay.
We donated some of the meat to a local sporting club that was raising money for youth, and they had made it in a couple of recipes. So we ate the prime parts, but then some of the some other parts. Edible, of course.
Sure.
And they used it for different things at their little banquet. And then they had a lot of their wild game too. So I only did it once,
yeah.
And it was fine.
Yeah. I've heard some people like rant and rave. It's like a mix between a bear and a deer. And other people say, oh, it's the worst thing going. I think it's how you prepare it.
I think so, too. And I'm so grateful to some of the hunting shows today that have a segment in it about cooking.
Sure.
It used to be just horn porn.
Yeah.
And now it's more about, wow, backstraps, tenderloins. Let's take 5 minutes and show you how to cook this stuff. And here's a great recipe for this or that. And Steve Rinella on Meat Eater. And a lot of different shows are coming out with cooking shows about whether it's fish or whether it's wild game. And that's really good, because we as hunters have known that all along. The non-hunting public may have thought we're only hunting them for trophies and that's it. And I don't know of anybody that does that.
It's illegal a lot of places.
It really is. It really is.
I like to give a shout out to Hank Shaw. He's got a couple of great cookbooks, Buck Moose.
He really does. He does.
I made a fish recipe of his. It's super simple. It's a Vietnamese fish stew, and it's like jalapenos, onions. You basically like brown one side of the fish. You cut them in like 2-inch by 2-inch cubes. You take it off so it's only halfway cooked, and then with the sauteed onions, the jalapenos that you've seeded, as well as like a little bit of fish stock and fish sauce, you then bring that to a boil, put your fish back in it, and man, it is so good. It's very mild, but it's got that little kick to it.
Well, for years we've always heard about lamb shanks.
Yeah.
But what about deer shanks?
His recipe is, you've tried it? Oh my God.
So we tried it last year, and I thought, why haven't I been doing this for 20 years? It is so good, and I always thought, just like turkey legs. I'm not going to deal with those turkey legs because they're all full of this bones and ligaments and stuff. But there's a way to do that. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with the shanks. And what I didn't know is that connective tissue melts when it's warm and blends flavor into the meat, and the meat is just so delicious. It is wonderful. And I've told a couple people of that, and it's even been on Bowsite.com, and people are going, Paul, thank you so much.
You're the only person I've talked to who's done that.
Oh, it's wonderful. Well, even turkey legs. So it's the best meat there is. The breasts are pretty tasteless and firm. And but the legs, that dark meat, and it's moist. You put it in a crock pot with a big can of cream and mushroom soup and cook it down. And then just reach in and pull out the major bone and the ligaments there, and you got about 10 of those, and then that leaves all that great meat, and you throw in some baby potatoes and some onions and some celery and some carrots, and make a nice stew. Put that over noodles or mashed potatoes, and Trisha and I just love that stuff. Yeah,
I'm glad to hear that. You put a huge smile on my face.
Yeah.
We got a couple of minutes left here. I have a few questions. Before I get to those questions, I was curious what your thoughts are on wolves.
Yeah.
To give you a little background, I was just talking with Gerald, and he was talking about how he has been aware of wolves up in Parker and east of Parker for the last 20, 30, 40 years.
Could be.
And obviously there is that established pack that's there now attacking that guy's cattle and stuff. And I'm very curious just what your thoughts are on wolves in Colorado. Obviously, we have to somehow reintroduce them even though they're here.
Yeah. Well, from the get-go. There was two groups in Colorado that were opposed to wolf reintroduction. One was StopTheWolf.org, which from the Western Slope, a gentleman named Denny Behrens and his group. And then there was Rethink the Wolf by the Cattlemen group. So there were two different groups.
Yeah.
And they were going to raise money and create advertisements of why bringing wolves, forced reintroduction of wolves to Colorado was not a good thing, not only for the livestock industry, but for wildlife in general.
Sure.
And since these wolves were only going to be reintroduced on the West Slope people were going to take the burden of whatever might happen come from introducing wolves there, not the people on the East Slope
that voted for it.
So Denny called me up, and I joined that organization. I was the Northeast coordinator for that. And I gave seminars not only to the Larimer County commissioners, because 39 other counties out of 64 signed resolutions by the county commissioners to be against the forced reintroduction of wolves to Colorado.
Really?
Yes.
39 out of 64.
Yes. And basically that was most of the West and most of the East, except up and down the Front Range. So I went to Larimer County, and I, with my regional planning background, I knew I only had 3 minutes to testify. So I read in my 3 minute testimony. Thank you. And I gave them a workbook. I said, here's the facts, here's the figures, here's the outcomes, here's the goals and objectives. Here's some resolutions already signed by some of the other counties that you could copy. I said, if nothing else, do two things. Support the other counties that have already signed resolutions against reintroduction of wolves because they realize what wolf reintroduction might do to their county, economically, socially, da-da-da. And so the other thing was what? Support the Division of Wildlife.
Right.
Because if you have a wildlife issue in the county, they'll come in and help mitigate that issue. All right. Well, I got word back later they didn't want to get involved politically. So the counties that voted more yeses than noes was starting at Larimer County, went down to Adams, went down to Boulder, went down to Denver, went down to Colorado Springs. So there's five. Six maybe, and then there was either Vail or Aspen, and then two counties over near Durango.
Yeah.
Those are the seven counties that had more. Everybody else said no.
The giant population centers.
That's right. So it was mostly like up and down the Front Range that made the difference, and we lost by less than 40,000 votes. It was nip and tuck right to the end.
I remember, it was like 50.5%.
That's right. So back in when the first wolf was killed on the interstate, the site of Glenwood Springs, back in the late 90s, early 2000s. She had a collar around her neck. She had migrated down from Wyoming.
Yeah.
And she was one of the Yellowstone wolves. She traveled over 12,000 miles, just 1,200 miles just to kind of go across country and seeking a new home, seeking a mate, who knows. But she was killed on the interstate.
Yeah.
So at that time, the governor and the Division of Wildlife said, let's put together a team of varieties of people across Colorado and have them put together a wolf plan. Mm-hmm. And the concern was, and the subject was, if and when wolves migrate into Colorado, how are we going to handle that in migration? One wolf, two wolves, 10 wolves. So they came up with a plan. They came to this conclusion, since they're federally protected as an endangered species,
right,
we'll let them wander. We'll let them do what wolves do. We'll let them find the terrain they wanted to. We'll let them mate. We'll let them raise their young. If the wolves get in trouble, we'll try the least method of take, least lethal method of take. If one gets in real trouble, we'll have to dispatch it. So that was their plan in a nutshell.
Right.
And the Wildlife Commission signed off onto it. So it's a resolution that the Wildlife Commission signed off on.
Really?
It's not anti-wolf. We'll let wolves migrate in naturally. Okay, so what's the situation today? So prior to the ballot initiative, the pro-wolfers said, first of all, the pro-wolfers want wolves in their historic range across the United States. Wherever wolves have been, they want to have them back there in most cases.
Right.
All right. Downtown Chicago, probably not, but maybe in the suburbs or the hitherland, who knows. But yeah. So, quote unquote, we've been waiting long enough for wolves to migrate through the gauntlet of Wyoming because they're a predator except around Yellowstone. Once they get out of that area and head anywhere in Wyoming, they can be shot on sight and there's no open season. I don't even think there's an open season. You don't even have to have a license. Okay. So the chances of a wolf, they say, getting from Yellowstone and migrating into Colorado to develop a home here and have pups and create a sustaining amount of wolves in Colorado is nil. We've been waiting 25 years, they say. So we're gonna bring it on a ballot initiative and let the citizens of Colorado vote on whether they want wolves in Colorado or not. And so they went out and they got $1.4 million. 90% of that money came from out of state.
Yep.
The Tide Foundation in California, Defenders of Wildlife, a biodiversity guy in Boulder, Sierra Club of Colorado, Tim Ferriss, and his followers, the Zoo and Aquarium Fund.
Really?
They all pitched in, and $1.4 million, they paid people to go out and get signatures. They got their 150,000 signatures. They got it on the ballot, and it passed by less than 40,000 votes. So the ballot initiative states this. Wolves will be on the ground by the end of December 2023,
yep.
No later. And cattlemen will be compensated fairly.
If they can prove it.
Yes, yeah. Is it actual or is it probable or is it this and that?
Right.
Okay, so it passed. So now the state has to develop a plan and then get Wolves on the ground by no later than December 23.
Yeah.
So the states north of us, since 1995 and earlier, have had Wolves either from Canada or just they were there.
Yeah, Idaho has a huge issue.
That's true.
Yeah.
So and this is under federal control now. The federal said this, since Wolves are under the Endangered Species Act in the United States, okay, we're going to follow that environmental impact statement to bring back the Wolves to part of their historic range, and we're going to use them as a experimental population in Yellowstone and Idaho. Even though they might have a few Wolves there, we're going to do this anyway.
Uh-huh.
So they did it. I mean, this is a nutshell thing.
Sure.
So they brought, in 1994 or 5, they brought 34 Wolves into Yellowstone and they 34 Wolves into Idaho. They said once Wolves get to be 15 mating pairs and maybe 300 Wolves in each state, we'll let the states take over control through hunting methods.
Right.
But prior to them getting to 300, and even after that, when the states wanted to take advantage of that, the pro-wolfers took those plans to court and got a judge to look it over, and they found little loopholes. And they maybe were loopholes.
Right, but just changing the recovery objective.
That's right. That's exactly true. So they postponed turning the management to the states by enough years that now there's 2,000 Wolves in those three states, and some of them migrated into Washington, and there's a few in Northern California. So during the Trump administration, they delisted the Wolves. Okay, federally across the United States. So now the states, whatever state had Wolves, they can develop their own wolf plan.
Yep.
Well, that just got overturned.
Oh, it did?
It did. So over a month and a half ago, the Defenders of Wildlife went to California, went to a circuit court, found or had a lawyer. He read over the plan and said, federal government, you haven't shown where the wolf is actually going to recover in its historic range. Oh yeah, you can't use the Great Lakes area and the Wyoming Northern Rockies recovery area as proof of that. So we need more expansion. Okay. And so they relisted them back to endangered. So now, even though the state plan is ongoing, they haven't even developed a state plan, but here's what they did. They brought all the experts from those three states north of us who have dealt with this for 30 years and brought them into Denver. They developed a SAG committee, which is made up of local sports people and cattlemen and small town governors, brought into a committee. And the goal there was to get a lot of public input, pros, cons, indifferent. And then the SAG committee would bring in their technical advice. And then those two groups would get together, as they did in Denver a couple months ago.
Yeah.
And I sat in on that meeting for 2 days, and they discussed basically compensation. How are we going to compensate livestock losses based on our experience in the three states above us?
Right.
So there's a variety of ways they can do that. They can say, okay, well, I saw a wolf kill that one. There's tracks around it. There's evidence a wolf killed it. We'll give you the fair market value. Here's another one over here. Well, it's a probable. We'll maybe pay you half the price. Maybe they'll pay. Some states will pay full price.
Right.
Wyoming has a multiplier effect of 7. If we find a dead cattle and said, yeah, a wolf did it, we'll pay you for that cow. But we figure then there's 6 more up there in the timber that the wolf pack might have killed. We'll pay you 7 times. They're the only state that does that. They're paying out more compensation than anybody. Most states are probably doing actual full probable or half a probable, and maybe with no multiplier effects. But that decision hasn't been decided on, because the plan hasn't even been built yet. This is just input going in.
Yeah.
That's what that is. So when the wolves up in Walden, that pack, that they mated, they had 4, so there's 6 of them up there.
Yep.
So there's and it's a pack. So there's male, female, and I think one of the female pups got collared, and that probably left the other 3 too. But anyway, they killed 2 cattle up there and a dog, maybe maimed another one. The state had to do an emergency hazing act to allow that rancher to go up and do a variety of hazings, not killing. They can use electrical fences. They can use flagging. They can use these little butane cannons to scare the wolves away. They've had meetings about that. They've had people come in to try to help, to be range riders, to help protect that situation up there. So the plan's still being developed. So now that they're delisted, what does that really mean? Does that mean that the state's not going to be having wolves? No, it's not. So the state is under the obligation to do their wolf plan.
But they're not going to be able to manage them because it is...
Well, not yet. So what I've heard recently is that since they're under federal protection, the state is going to... They don't really know all the ins and outs of what the feds are going to require of them, but they have some idea. But they're going to continue on the plan just like it wasn't under federal protection. Just like they were going to release them at the end of December. The feds have basically said, we're going to try to come up with our environmental impact statement or assessment in parallel to your developing your plan. Okay. And hopefully maybe meet the same date. And then, yeah, wolves will be on the ground, but we're going to give you input on maybe we're going to look at where you want to reintroduce them, how many you're going to do it, how you're going to do it. We'll kind of oversee that. My personal guess is that it's going to happen.
Yep.
It's not going to be delayed unless the environmental impact statement takes longer than it might be delayed a few months or a year.
Could there be a federal injunction on it, just not allow it to happen or delay it? Maybe not.
Yeah. Who knows? I don't know that.
Okay.
It's
very tricky, but man,
it is
quite convoluted.
Well, so it's not going to be the end of the world. So,
well, they're already here, right?
Yeah, and that didn't make any difference. But it's not going to be in the new world. We won't know that. So wolves aren't going to be going on the ground for 2 years. And so how many are going to be there? Let's say we got 4 wilderness areas and they dump in 10 wolves per. So we got 40. The growth rate of a wolf pack is 27%. So let's say they have 3 cubs. Well, one or two of those are going to die just naturally. So it's going to grow, but not it's not going to inflate itself tremendously. What impact is going to have on our wildlife? Nobody knows that. It's just anecdotal evidence from other states.
Sure,
they're going to kill elk and deer and maybe a moose, but we don't know how many, and we don't know how the game management plans from the Division of Wildlife is going to be adjusted as wolves get on the ground.
Yep.
So we don't know how many wolves are going to be in Colorado at any one time. Are they going to go and say, we're just going to have 200 wolves, and once they get beyond that, we're going to allow hunting if there's social tolerance for it? The social tolerance might be, well, we need to trap those wolves and relocate them somewhere else. We don't want anybody shooting them. Things like that are coming up in our state today. And so, first of all, I've got some idea. It's going to be a wilderness area, most likely. They're going to try to put them farther enough away from cattle associations, but these wolves migrate 150 miles. They can travel 70 miles a day easily.
And one came from Yellowstone.
That is true. They're going to kill. A couple hundred cattle a year.
Sure.
And maybe one rancher more than others. Okay. I don't think they're going to kill 500 cattle. I don't think there's any state that has 400 cattle dead that they could really prove.
Yeah.
Maybe a couple hundred. They're going to kill, like the bears kill. Cost the Division of Wildlife $30,000 a year for all the bear kills on sheep recently. So wolves will probably get into that a little bit. What effects are going to have on the moose population? Nobody knows that, just anecdotal evidence. So it's not going to be the end of the world for elk hunters. I don't think we're going to have wolves running all over the place. I think they're going to be capped somewhere. Depends on what, some gal that read the peer review of the delisting for the federal government says, oh, it's enough overstory for having 1,000 wolves in Colorado. She's just thinking about overstory.
Yeah.
I heard talk about 500 wolves in Colorado. There's enough prey here. Okay. Well, basically, kind of hunters are kind of the wolves in Colorado.
Yeah.
And we're regulated. Wolves aren't going to be regulated.
Exactly.
So it's still, to finalize the question is, it's all going to depend on what influence the federal government has to have on the state plan, whether they go parallel with it, whether they add some advice, whether they take some topics away. They've put in their things, they put in their comments about how it should be, how they've been doing it over the years under the environmental impact statement. So we will know probably in another year how they all finalize it. It's supposed to be approved by June of 2023.
Okay.
So that gives them about 6 months to bring the wolves in from a similar state, like Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, whether they could put them in pens like they did Yellowstone, or they just let them go on their own, or put them, bring them down in family groups. So
up in the air.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I appreciate all that insight, man. It sounds like you've spent a lot of time thinking about this, researching it, putting some boots on the ground after it. So I appreciate that.
I've always tried to get, and that's why I attend these meetings also, because I want to get as much information I can from what the proverbial horse's mouth. I don't believe in the SSS idea about wolves. If I ever accidentally shot a wolf, I'd turn myself in and say, hey, this is what happened. Because I like the biological aspect of it.
Yeah, thank you. I just don't know if we have.
And that's the whole key. I think most of us didn't want them forced. It was going to cost a lot of money. Well, here's the other thing that I'll need to straighten out. So where's the money going to come from to pay for the wolf reintroduction in the Colorado?
Yeah.
So in the ballot initiative, it said it will not come out of hunting and fishing wild game cash funds, big game cash funds. That's hunting and fishing license fees. It won't come from there. So they have to find other sources.
Yeah.
So Perry Wills, who used to be with the Division of Wildlife, then became a legislator on the House side, passed a bill and got it passed for at least the first fiscal year, $1.1 million to cover costs there.
Okay.
But when I was at the roundtable caucus meeting a month ago, we were told that it's going to cost a lot more than that. And he's hoping, Perry Wills is to get that bill passed every year or two to extend that funding, because it's going to cost over $1 million, and maybe even twice that much for monitoring, putting in the wolves, and then staff to this, and then compensation to landowners and things like that out of that money. So it's going to cost a lot more than just a few $1,000 a year. It's going to cost at least $1 million or more plus per year for the next 20 years or more.
That's not going towards another cause.
Yeah, and so we really don't know the total impact that the wolves are going to have. Some of the impacts that people think the wolves did up in the northern states isn't true. There's other reasons why elk die, through hunters, through more licenses, through drought, through this and that.
Sure.
And sure, wolves played a part in some of those areas, but they weren't the end all.
No.
So there's a lot of factors out there that I try to dig up and
I appreciate you bringing some nuance to it, because it's easy as hunters to say, like, oh, these are going to screw up everything, screw up all the numbers. It's going to change the dynamics, but
yeah.
It's not necessarily going to ruin your next year.
Yeah, they found out this about some wolves in some states, is that the wolves have a tendency, or the elk have a tendency when wolves are around to be in the thick timber.
Yeah.
They don't want to be out in the opens where they could be chased. So hunters might have to change up their tactics of how they hunt elk less so in the open areas and more so in the thicker timber.
Yeah.
I had some friends that hunted Idaho years ago, and they said, when we heard elks, knew there were elk in the area and there was wolves in the area, we'd need to get on those elk right away, because if there was wolves in the area, they kept them moving.
Yeah.
They just didn't bed down and graze around like they normally were, that we'd get them on the next day or the next. We couldn't wait that long. We had to get on them right then. And yeah.
It's fascinating.
It really is. And
you've given me a lot of your time here. I want to bring it back towards your hunting experiences a little bit here. I have two closeout questions here.
Sure.
One is, in your very long hunting career, do you have a situation that was like a bit precarious or a bit sketchy that you got yourself into, especially with all the solo hunting, that just sticks out in your mind? You know, I've had guys talk about, I shouldn't have chased that sheep over that cliff, or I shouldn't have gone down that ravine, whatever it might be. I'm curious if you have one of those.
Well, one was a precarious situation when I was hunting mountain goats up in the mountains, and to get to the goats on a salt lick, I had to go across this a boulder field off to the and try to get downwind of these goats. And so as I inched my way across this boulder field, and these boulders were basketball size plus car size, not quite that big. But I got about 100 yards into that, and some of them started moving. And I clung to those rocks like a spider on the wall. I could just visualize myself going down the hill with these rocks and being buried for life, and nobody would ever know where I was.
Yeah.
And I inched my way back and got off that boulder field and left those animals where they were and hunted them someplace else. And that was a scary situation.
I believe it.
So I haven't had too many other scary situations, except when I was in Idaho. No, not Idaho. Where was I? Out east somewhere. Uh-huh. Visiting some friends. I was hunting deer 20 miles away. It was cold. I had lots of clothes on. I had two pairs of those wool GI liner gloves.
Uh-huh.
and I'd put screw steps in the tree, and I hauled my strap-on tree stand up there, and I hunted for a couple hours, and it was cold. I didn't see any deer. I said, it's time to go. I lowered my bow down on a string and put it around the tree. I lowered the tree stand down, and I'm standing on one of the steps below where there was a step right at arm length, and I had the other foot on a limb, and I'm unscrewing it, and as I unscrewed it, it came out quicker than I thought, and I ended up just falling backwards, and I dropped 12 feet down, and luckily there was nothing on the ground except frozen pavement, but I had enough clothes on, and I didn't land square on my back to knock the wind out of me, but I landed a little bit on my left side of my butt and went boom, boom.
Wow.
And you lie there for a while thinking, oh, did I just break anything? And I kind of recovered, and I got up, and I went, oh, man. So I went up and I got my tree stand and I got my tree steps. And as I'm hiking out, I'm feeling this bulging area in my rear end, and it's puffing up.
Yeah.
And as I get back to my truck, and I have a Ford truck with a bench seat in it, I couldn't sit on the bench seat because one side of my butt was all swollen up. I'd broken about a bunch of veins in my right butt. And I had to sit way over to the door so my butt would fit in that little hole there. So I get back to my buddy's house, and I'm kind of sweating, but I said, I'll be okay. Give me a couple of ibuprofens, and I go to bed. But I wake up at midnight just pouring sweat. We ended up at emergency wards, and I strip down, and the doctor looks at me and says, I've never seen such black and blue marks for your waist down to my knees on both sides. And luckily, so they took some x-rays, and everything was okay. But it took almost 2 months for all that black and blue came around. But you hear every year of someone falling out of a tree stand and being parallels for life, or hanging upside down, and their cell phone drops out of their pocket. They can't find anybody. They die there.
Yeah.
And so that was a blessing that I didn't land on my neck and paralyzed, or just still there, and the rabbit hunters found me the next year. So,
man, that is a scary one. And it's just like Gerald reiterated this on his episode, is just, you got to use a harness. You got to
really
think about how you're approaching these things. And it's interesting because the Western hunting seems so much more daunting than climbing up in a tree stand in your backyard. But anytime you're on an elevated platform, especially in a place that you're super comfortable, because I think with the Western hunting, at least for me, is like, I'm aware of every single step I take out in the woods, every branch that could poke me in the eye or whatever might happen. Whereas if you're in your own backyard and you see deer are there all the time, and that tree's been there for 20 years and you've been there for 20 years, well, it might be easy to take things for granted. So
I've got a friend that used to be a paratrooper, and he doesn't use any harnesses. He's, he thinks he can still jump, you know, out of a plane and land safely. But he's a couple years older than I am.
Yeah.
And he's not doing it anymore. But I can just see someday I'm going to get a note from his wife that he's on the ground and he's not with us anymore.
Scary. Yeah, yeah. So one last thing. Is there anything that you've picked up over the years, something that you wish you could go tell yourself in your 20s and your 30s, something you wish you learned earlier?
About hunting?
Sure.
Oh, or just in life in general?
I'll take both.
Okay. My wife of 40 years tells me that I've matured a lot. And I take that as a compliment.
Sure.
Yeah. And she's a wonderful gal. And she supports me in all my hunting. And she says, Paul, if you need to go 30 days, go. And she loves wild game. And that's really nice. And she'll lift the lid of the freezer and say, I don't see any elk meat. Don't come home until you get one. But she's involved in theater, and she keeps busy and I keep busy. And then, we have our times together, and that's great too. So I think I've matured in life, how I oversee things in life. I know I'm not going to be on this earth 20 years from today. So you kind of think about that a little bit. I think I like to talk to people, because I was born in the 40s and 50s, and I didn't have an iPhone, and I didn't text, and I've never texted yet. So I like to have eye-to-eye, face-to-face conversations with people, and it's so easy to strike up a conversation. So many people are texting today, they don't have a conversation eye-to-eye. So when I go to the coffee shop, all you got to do is ask somebody a simple question like, I'm fascinated by your laptop there. What are you doing today? Some guys will say, I'm conducting sales business trips right now, or I'm working out of my office, but I happen to be down here having a cup of coffee. It's amazing what people can do today in their Bermuda shorts and tank tops, and and work on a computer and direct salespeople out in the field, yeah. where I had to drive around in a Mercedes and three-piece suit and do mine. So that's always interesting. So what I've learned, I think, be healthy. I weigh about 12 pounds more than I did in high school in 1958 playing football. I go to the gym and work out. And if I want to keep doing what I want to do today, I want to go solo elk hunting this year. I want to keep on hunting because that's my blood. That's in my blood. I love doing that stuff. Yeah. And I like to get involved with the CBA and being the Northeast delegate for the Division of Wildlife in that area, and was on the board of directors and was the banquet chairman 4 years ago and was the division liaison for 6 years. I just love that stuff. And that all comes from the bow hunting community. So I love to bow hunt, but I want to be involved in the bow hunting community. And luckily, I still have the mindset to do that and the strength to do that. But if you're going to go hunting and want to do it at my age, you got to be strong. And so I'm strong enough to pull back a 55-pound recurve in my compound bow. I'm strong enough to hike with 30 pounds, 40 pounds on my back. Not 40 is pushing it, but 35 pounds. And I've learned to, you know, elk hunt. I've learned a lot about from wildlife, but I like to study what wildlife's doing, you know, and how to hunt them when and what they're doing when I'm hunting. So I've become pretty good at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just enjoy it.
I love it, man. The first word I wrote down when we sat down together is longevity. So I think be healthy is a great tip.
It really is. It really is. I eat a lot of fruit. I eat a lot of salads, but I eat wild game. I eat eggs, salads, drink a lot of water, which is really important, staying hydrated. I could go out here and drink beer, but I don't because if I have one beer a month, it just doesn't work with my system. Alcohol, I might have a vodka and juice, but I'll drink half of it at home because it just doesn't work for me.
Sure.
I used to smoke years and years ago, but I haven't smoked for 30 years or 40 years, so I don't do that. So,
man,
yeah.
I really appreciate your time, Paul. I love you sharing these stories and coming out and everything you've done for the CBA. We thank you so much. And man, I hope I can get you back on here a year from now and hear about another, let's see here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 plus 15 geese.
Yeah.
That would be great.
How about 10 years from now?
Let's do it.
Years
from now, maybe I'll have my first elk to tell you.
I'm going to write that down in my life plan, and I'll see you in 10 years.
Hopefully, a year between now and then.
God bless you, man. Thank you.
Paul.